Good afternoon, folks. It's that time of the day again. Time for the elephant in the room here on WJAS 1320 AM and Talk 99.1 FM. This is your host, Sam DeMarco, here joined in studio, as usual, by my trusty executive director, John Schneider, best executive director in any Republican committee in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Thanks, Sam.
You're welcome, John. Hey, that was two words, Daryl. He said two words, okay?
That was two.
I guess to meet his quota or quotient of three, he'll have one more.
We'll just start the month.
There you go. Yeah, we'll do a reset.
Hey.
And folks, you're hearing from our producer, dazzling Daryl Grandy.
Morning,
Sam. Good morning. The man who makes the magic happen, who gets what we're talking about here to you folks and on our podcasts, which are available on Amazon, Apple, and Spotify. Again, that's the elephant in the room. And folks, we have a great show for you today. And this is a really interesting show for me as well, because we are joined in studio today by a longtime friend, Bob Brooks. And Robert Bob Brooks is a former Republican member of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, where he represented the 54th District from 2018 to 2023. Now, previously, he served as the borough of Murraysville mayor for a total of 26 years. Oh, I'm sorry, served 26 years as councilman and mayor. In 2015, he was named Pennsylvania's Mayor of the Year by the Pennsylvania State Mayors Association. Now, Bob, while he served in public life, has also been extremely successful in private life. He was a chief financial officer at Chrysler Corporation. At one point, he was a chief financial officer at Wabtec. He is involved in sports. He owns the Pittsburgh Indoor Sports Arena and was part of a group of local businessmen that helped save the Pirates and the Penguins. So Bob has been a big part of what's taken place here in Pittsburgh. And but he's also been somebody that is low key and just, he's a worker and just tends to fly under the radar. And that's why we are so happy to have him in studio today, because we're going to pull back the covers and let folks get a glimpse of who Bob Brooks really is. Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Sam. First, I want to say happy birthday.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I not only saw so much about that, but I see a lot of thank yous that you're giving out to other people. Everybody must have told you happy birthday.
There's a few. I guess it's, Bob, it's one of the, I guess, the benefits of growing old, right? You know, we meet a lot of people along the way, and those folks are just happy you're still here, and I'm still here as well. But thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
That's great. Well, it's always great to celebrate a birthday. I mean, the other side of it isn't so good. So,
well, yeah, we always joke, right? People always say, "How are you doing today?" I say, "Well, hey, you know, any day you wake up looking down on the ground instead of up is a good day."
Exactly.
Right.
There you go.
You know. So,
well, I appreciate you having me. That it's not often you get to tell your story or relive your story. I was lucky. I grew up in New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
and you're either a suburb of Philadelphia or a suburb of New York. I was a suburb of Philadelphia, and it was a great place to live. Small town, and schools right there in town, so you could easily walk. It was really nice.
What was the name of the town?
It's called Winona.
Okay.
It was outside of Woodbury. The high school's Woodbury. And then we were right by Camden, so okay. Just outside Philly. And I was born in Camden. So, But anyway, it was great. My dad worked for Mobil Oil, and he was a research chemist. So he's got patents all over his wall kind of thing. But it was a great place to grow up, because you did a lot of sports, you did a lot of activities, and you were involved in everything. You were helping your neighbor. I remember my first great teacher lived across the street,
mm-hmm.
And so it was just a neighborhood. And that's what I love about Murraysville, where I live today. It's a neighborhood. It's a small town, a little bigger than Winona. Murraysville's about 25,000. Winona was probably 1,200. But it's almost the same.
So it's like small-town America, sort of like, you know, not a hallmark, so to speak, but you know, but similar, right?
Exactly the kind of place you want to raise your kids.
Okay.
So, anyway, I've been very fortunate. I went to Franklin Marshall College, which was out in Lancaster, and in the Amish, mm-hmm. Pennsylvania Dutch, and I still go back there a lot to do the sight and sound theater. I'm on the board out there at the college.
Okay.
I've been for 20 years. The rule is you're supposed to be on the board for 2 5-year terms, and then take a year off. I'm still waiting for that year off. Yeah. So, but it's really great because you work with the youth. You get to see the stars in their eyes and wow. the future that's going to be right. our future because of them. So it, I love it. And then I went after Franklin Marshall. I was a mathematics major. And then I went to the Wharton School in Pennsylvania, Philly.
Wow.
And actually, Donald Trump went to the Wharton
yes,
School.
Yes, he did.
He went to the undergrad. Good. I went to the grad, but it was the same school.
You must have had good grades to get into the Wharton School of Business. Now I can see how why you were so successful here in business.
Well, I always said, go to an undergraduate school that will get you into the graduate school you want.
Okay.
And then get the best graduate school you can for what you want to do.
Hey, you always wanted to, I mean, did you know what you wanted to do? When you went to Franklin Marshall, what did you major in?
So I was a pre-med.
Okay.
So obviously I changed because I'm not, I am a doctor, but it's a PhD.
Better to own a hospital than work at it, right? Hey.
But so it was great. And, you know, I enjoyed it. I was on the tennis team, the track team. I did things that were, you know, good for your body as well as your mind. But as a pre-med, you were in the library an awful lot of the time. And, you know, then I took math courses. I found how easy that was. And then I took some business courses, accounting, and it was even easier. And so I said, well, maybe this is where I belong. And so that's where I switched to a finance major. And then at Wharton, I was corporate finance and computers. Mm-hmm. And then the great thing is Chrysler came and said, you're the kind of guy we want. So I said, I'm your guy.
And I match made in heaven.
Yeah. So I was married at the time. My wife, I said, the only thing is we don't hear a lot of good things about Detroit. This is 67. And so the riots were all happening right. 67, 68. And so they said, well, come on out. We'll show you. And they took us to all the best places we never saw. And it was really great. And then so we went to Chrysler. I really enjoyed it. I was on what they call a training team. Mm-hmm. Every 6 months, I took a different job in a different location.
Okay.
And so I did that for 2 years. And at the end of the 2 years, then you take a permanent placement, which is really only a year job. And then they switch you to another place for a year. And again, you're gaining experience all the time.
You're learning the breadth and scope of the business, right? All yeah. the different areas and how they
people that work. Say they won't take a lateral, mm-hmm. that's wrong. Take the laterals. Get the experience. You have that background that you build up. It's invaluable. So, you know, it's not always you got to look to go up. Mm-hmm. Build that background. And then up will happen. So I was very lucky. Chrysler was a great place. I went to Mexico and worked one of my assignments in Mexico. I was in New Orleans doing the rocket ships for the space program. And then I was in several places in Indiana and Detroit. But financially, Chrysler got into a little bit of trouble. Mm-hmm. And so
this is back in the Lee Iacocca days, right?
We brought Lee Iacocca in.
Yeah. Okay.
And Lee Iacocca put together a team of 16 people. I was one of the 16.
Oh, wow.
And I was in Indianapolis. We had three plants down there. And so I would come up every Thursday night and spend all day Friday with Lee and the rest of the team. And we'd decide what to do for the next 2 weeks. We never planned more than 2 weeks. But, you know, one of the problems that car companies have is the engineers take like 5 years to design a car. And Lee Iacocca said, why 5 years? Let's do it in 3 years. Mm-hmm. And it turns out in 3 years, you get 90% of what you would have gotten in 5 years. And it comes out better, and people get new, and grows. And so he was quite a dynamic leader from that. He wasn't much of a spokesman. Mm-hmm. So we said, but you got to be our guy to the community.
Right.
So we sent him to school.
Yeah.
And he learned to speak, and then he would practice with us. And then he actually went out and convinced the public that Chrysler was the safest, the best, and the car that would be, you know, around for a long time, and he would take care of it. And so people then started buying Chrysler, the old K car, the box. And it just was great. After about 2 years with Lee, and the company was well back on its feet, paid the government back 100% of everything that they had borrowed, then a phone call started. Anybody that was on the team is looked to go somewhere else. And that's when WABTEC called me and said, we've got this facility in Pittsburgh that makes brakes for trains. George Westinghouse designed this back in basically the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. They used to have guys on trains that every train, they had a flagman on the train. And the guy in the engine would flag, and then every car would do the flag signal all the way down the train so that people knew when we were getting ready to brake, when we were getting ready to speed up, turn. The only problem was every now and then you'd have to go through a tunnel. And I think everybody had to duck down on the top of the train to wait to get through the tunnel. But it was a little archaic. So George Westinghouse designed a brake, air brake, that goes all the way through the train. And if you'll notice on trains today, same technology, they have these what they call glad hands. It's a pipe with a rubber pipe with two hands that hook the cars together. Mm-hmm. But just to pass the air. They have a coupler to hold the cars together.
Right.
But this is to hold the air. And so when the locomotive generates the air, it fills a reservoir, and the reservoir in every car. And then if they put on the brakes, the reservoir dumps the air. And if you have no air, the brakes automatically go on.
Oh, wow.
So the brakes only go on when there's no air, if there's air. And that's why a runaway train, when they show where a train brakes and the back end
the air gets dumped, so it automatically brakes. Yes.
Yeah, it can't. You can't have a runaway train. So, you know, it's pretty cute. But anyway, it's a technology that's used all around the world. There are only two technologies in the world, and we have what we call an AAR style, which is long distances between stations, mountains, and brakes that have to be applied with a lot of pressure. And we have, in Europe, it's called a UIC brake, which is short distances, a lot of cities, and, you know, the speed isn't important, and you don't have the mountains. So what you'll find is probably half the world is AAR, and half the world is UIC. And when I was at the air brake, we were with a company called American Standard. American Standard owned WABTEC and WABCO in those days. And American Standard was kind of tried to be taken over by an outside group that they didn't want to be taken over by. Mm-hmm. So they looked for a white knight, and that's how they finally got this company that was several divisions. So there's Train Air Conditioning. There was the plumbing. There was
fluid power. Because I recognize American Standard plumbing products.
Right. That was the main parent. Mm-hmm. And so then what happened is they went private. Everybody was doing MBOs, LBOs. Mm-hmm. And so they went private. And there were a lot of us that were able to be a part of that. Okay. And it was kind of fun because now you were owners of the company.
Right.
And what they would do here in Pittsburgh, we had Union Switch and Signal, we had Fluid Power, we had Westinghouse Air Brake, and then all around the country they had all these other kind of divisions. Mm-hmm. And so the debt got to be a pretty high number, and so what they had decided was they were going to sell off some of these non-core divisions and pay off the debt, and then, you know, life would go on. But as it happened, some of the divisions weren't as profitable as they were hoped to be at the time they wanted to sell them. So they looked around and they said, I think we're going to sell Westinghouse. And so they actually put us up for sale. I spent, I was the head of finance at that time. And so my job and about four others was to try and sell the company. Mm-hmm. We found a European company that was going to buy us. They were a brake company in England. And probably 1 month before it was supposed to be all done, they dropped their price by $100 million. And of course, that was a shock. And it was all because of Italian operations. And so the head of American Standard came to us and said, look, if you guys want to buy it and you can do it for the same kind of price, you can have it. So we were very fortunate. Our CEO, Bill Castling, who is a Fox Chapel resident,
yep.
He was able to put together a consortium for financing, basically using European companies that wanted to be like the air brake. And they had little divisions, and now this was their chance to be a big division.
Okay.
And so we bought the company back in 1995. And 1990. We bought it in 1990. And now we had probably, I'd say, 60 people that were in our companies. And it was basically located here that all became owners of the company.
Wow.
And a lot of them mortgaged their houses, okay. And put everything they could into it. Because it was, if you're going to invest in something you know. Mm-hmm. And so they could have a direct impact on what they did. So then we had the company, we moved it around. We took a transit division and moved it to South Carolina. We took a locomotive division headquartered here in Pittsburgh, and then we moved the freight up into Hamilton, Canada. And so we basically were all North American. Our European pieces were sold to the European people. Mm-hmm. And so the thought was, we'll run this company for 5 years for these people that were the big financiers. At the end of 5 years, we'll sell it to them and, you know, all look for something else to do.
Right.
And as it turned out, 5 years later, just maybe 6 months short of that, the company that was the company going to take us over was bought out by another company because they had medical divisions and people right. wanted all that. And so they said, air brake? We don't want an air brake company. So we said, well, why don't we buy all that? Yeah. So we then took the company public and used that to actually buy the company. We took the company from a $300 million sales number to now it's $11.5 billion.
Wow.
And during those times from 1995, when we went public, till today, we've just seen tremendous growth and tremendous taking over of volumes throughout the world, such that our technology, George Westinghouse's technology, is still the preeminent safety equipment. And what I think is the best thing about the air brake, or Wabtec, is that it assures that trains operate safely. That's their main emphasis throughout the world. And so it was kind of a fun thing. Well, I was a director as well as a CFO, and finally I retired back in 2004. And I said, you know, I've been a councilman for a while, but in Murrysville, but I really would like to give back. So I went on the board of United Way. I became president of the Boy Scouts for the area. And I joined F&M as board in 2005. Mm-hmm. And so what I've tried to do is grow and become a member, giving back to the community since 2004. And like you said, I was lucky enough to be in a community where there's seven council people and a mayor. And all I had to do is convince four people that it was the right thing to do, mm-hmm. and we got it done. And so Murraysville, it was at the time, everybody said, we want to be able to come into Murraysville instead of going out of Murraysville to shop and to have fun. So during the time, I got a mall put in downtown where we used to have a swimming pool, mm-hmm. and now we had shops, Burgatory, North Park Lounge, Moe's, you know, all kinds of places as well as businesses, and it became like a downtown. And then I was able to cluster a bunch of, buy some farms, cluster some ball fields. So now we could have lots of places for kids to play, and parents could go to one field and see three different kids playing.
Wow, okay.
In that area. We built a miracle field, which now assures every child, no matter what the handicap,
right,
can play baseball. And it's so much fun to go out there and watch those kids with a counterpart from, say, the school, one of the sports teams, come in, and they buddy-buddy in the system. Mm-hmm. And it's there's an appreciation everybody gains. And the Pirates have done a great job of actually, it's Bill Mazeroski Field.
Okay.
For my golf partner. But they would have a lot of the Pirates come out and play catch with these boys and girls and just spend time with them. We wouldn't advertise it so that, you know, not a lot of people
right,
came
yeah.
to seek
signatures. You wanted the Pirates to be able to spend time with the kids.
The kids.
Right.
That's what it's all about.
Dude, that is phenomenal. I mean, they listen to this story, you know, about how it's one of the things, you know, people talk about someone's being lucky, okay? I've always been someone that believes that people make their own luck. You know, people call it luck, but it's hard work, pays off, and it's also recognizing opportunities when they present themselves.
That's what I've always said. When an opportunity comes, if you pass it by, you know, now, some opportunities might not be at that right point for you, but mm-hmm. if they are, take them, because it can't do anything but make you better. And the nice thing is, with only seven council people, it was great, because if you got four to see the vision, they did it. And we're lucky in Murraysville, most of our people are people that care about other people. Mm-hmm. And so it's very easy. When we did a Rails to Trails, when we did the ballparks in the parks, people get behind that. And we did it without raising taxes. The biggest advantage we had was we were growing. And if you grow, you get additional revenues, and that always helps.
Well, you hit the nail on the head here. One of the big things that you were able to do was you were able to take, and I don't want to say change, but you were able to take and convert or whatever a residential community into a mixed community, bringing business in. Because businesses pay taxes, but they're not so much the consumer of services. From a zoning and planning perspective, many of these municipalities that have focused just on residential find themselves having to raise taxes year after year, because every time they're building new homes, new families move in, they bring new children in, which means the schools, you know, need to grow and things like that. So no, that is fascinating how you were able to do that. And by doing so, by bringing restaurants, by bringing shopping stores or retail stores in, by bringing athletic things, the ball fields, you made it a more attractive place to live.
All I hear now is people that live in Penn Hills or in Plum, they all come to Murraysville instead of Murraysville having to
go to them,
Monroeville, yes. or where. So it's really been a change. Talking about luck again, back in the 96, I remember the Pirates were basically going to leave town.
Hold off on that story, because we're going to take a break here in about a minute, but I want you to be able to tell people that story, okay? How you were involved in that, how you got involved in helping to save the Pirates, you know, and the Penguins here, you know, becoming part of a local ownership group to step up. Because, I mean, again, you're talking about, Bob, you've been somebody, you know, from growing up in New Jersey, going to school, and then just working hard, being successful, but giving back has taken on a whole new, you know, a meaning in your life, and you've done it in so many ways. Folks, we're going to talk more with Bob Brooks here when we come back after the break. This is Sam DeMarco, the host of The Elephant in the Room on WJAS 1320 AM and Talk 99.1 FM. Be right back after the break. Welcome back, folks, to The Elephant in the Room. We were talking in the last segment here, we were talking with Bob Brooks, who's still here, but we were talking about his growing up in New Jersey, his business career, and Bob was about to talk about something very interesting here, his first entree into helping save some of our local sports teams. And Bob, you were just starting to talk about the Pittsburgh Pirates in the mid-90s here, so you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, I always figured, what would we be if we didn't have the sports teams that we have? And Toledo kept coming up on my mind.
Please, no. Please God, no.
Because I used to live in Detroit. Guess, you know. But I said, we are so fortunate in Pittsburgh. I mean, we have the universities, we have the medical community, we have the cultural arts, and we have the sports teams.
Yep.
Everything that would make people want to come to the city and stay. Well, cities without that can't get the engineers,
right.
Can't get the entrepreneurs. So we're very fortunate. We definitely couldn't afford to lose any of those.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, so in 1996, the Pirates had been sold by the Galbraith family to the city. Actually, there were several companies within the city. And they were just caretakers. They wanted to hold it a year or two and then have it become owned by someone. At the end of 2 years, which was 96, they said it was time. And so it was either going to move out of the city or it was going to stay. And fortunately, the Rooney's son had been a roommate of Kevin McClatchy.
Oh, wow, okay.
In California. And Kevin ran a AAA team out there. Mm-hmm. And loved baseball. And so they said, Kevin, why don't you come to Pittsburgh? And then my lawyer was Kevin's lawyer, and Dave Donino, who's Reed Smith.
Okay, yeah.
And he actually got a group of us all together, and we all put money in, and we bought the Pirates.
Oh, wow.
So it was really, I credit Reed Smith and Dave Donino as the person that did, but the Rooneys, who really cared, got Kevin, and Kevin was a person that just loved baseball. He, of course, he had all the newspapers that he was supposed to be running.
Yes.
His mother and his brother ran
yeah,
those.
Yeah.
But anyway.
He's a friend. He's a friend of mine. Good guy. Great guy.
He is a great guy. And so anyway, we put together this group, and I remember it was, we had a couple from Philadelphia, oil and gas, or a gas company. We had a couple from the South, and
Frank Fuhrer.
Fuhrer. Mm-hmm. And a couple of us. So there were probably 18 people altogether to get that kind of money. But what we did then is we started to have meetings and put together the entity for the future. And I can remember there were a couple of people that lived outside of Pittsburgh that still wanted to move it.
Okay.
And so, and they were on the board.
Right.
And so the key all came down to, if we had 5 years of losses, then they could move the team. And so we were starting down that road. And I remember Kevin had to go to an owner's meeting, so he asked me to sit in on his board seat. Mm-hmm. And at that board seat meeting, that's when two of the board members from outside of Pittsburgh brought it up that they were buying Frank out, and now they were going to have control, and they were going to move it out of Pittsburgh. And I thought, oh my gosh,
right?
I'm going to be a part of this. And so I got together. I said, oh, we can't do this at this meeting because you know, there's no notice of it, and Kevin's not here. So let's postpone it till Friday. This was, I think, Monday. No, postpone it to Friday. And so right after that, I remember Ogden's lawyers, Kevin's lawyers, myself, a couple others. We actually got together and we devised a plan. Well, we went to Frank and we bought Frank shares.
Okay.
And now it was kind of an even 50-50 mm-hmm. of instead of their being able to have controlling interest. So actually give credit to the organization in New York. They came down and said, look, this is going to stay in Pittsburgh. If you two guys want, we'll cash you out. And you, if you don't say bad things, you'll be able to buy a team somewhere in
the
future. Else.
So these were this was Major League Baseball.
Major League
Baseball. They came down to keep the team here.
And so, and they were really adamant at this, and Kevin was so adamant. And so basically, we saved it. And once you got rid of those board members, everybody was on the path to try and make it the greatest ballpark in here. And then Kevin just, he did a great job of promoting and trying to get PNC built.
Mm-hmm.
We eventually did get it. And the team, that was 2001, and the team has been exciting. And this year, it's been very exciting. Anytime you can make the playoffs is exciting. The last time we were in the playoffs, I saw Clint Hurdle at the Hall of Fame out mm-hmm. in Cooperstown earlier when Jim Leland went into the Hall of Fame. And I was talking to him, and he remembers how exciting it was
right.
when he was here and we were in the playoffs with Cincinnati. But it was a one-game playoff.
Yep.
What a terrible way to...
I still remember. I mean, it was electric. You had, you know, the folks, the chants that the fans were. And the Cincinnati reliever, right, Quinn, dropped the ball. He was so nervous. I mean, yes,
everybody
incredible.
Stood. The place was packed, and everybody stood the whole game. I mean, my wife complained she couldn't see because people were standing. All
yep,
the time.
Yep.
So, but it was electric. And, you know, we're getting back to that area. I would say this year we're going to win 74 games. You know, and that's a great number from where we've been. And that gets us on our path. Next year, I'm sure management's going to commit to 81 games. And, you know, it probably takes 84 games. To be in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. So next year, we have as close a chance as any to be in the playoffs, but the goal is the year after definitely in the playoffs. And they're building in that direction. We've spent money on a couple of long-term people. You know, people complain when we paid $10.4 million to Chapman to come in this year. I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. I love Chapman. I watched him when he saved the Cubs. And got them mm-hmm. their title. I remember they were having so much trouble out in the bullpen. They brought him in the sixth inning and kept him all the way through the ninth.
Yeah.
You know, just to get it done. And then he went from there to the Yankees, then he went to the Rangers, and now he's with us. But, you know, when he's on, he is so much fun to watch. And, yeah. of course, he did a nice job bringing that game back last night, which I was getting a little nervous about. But, yeah, so
yeah, better him than Rowdy. <You
know? laughs> But that's been a fun. And I think, you know, the city has benefited from it. The games are fun. They can be frustrating at times. And we're not going to make the playoffs this year. But we're getting to that point where we're going to be in the playoffs again. And that's exciting to me.
Well, Bob, one of the things I think is a longtime Pirate fan. I mean, you know, I grew up worshiping Roberto Clemente. You know, grew up in the era where I would listen to the AM radio and hear Bob Prince, you know, talk about the show where, you know, we'd be the kids, we'd be out catching, just throwing catch back and forth in the yard, listening to the games and dreaming about what might have been or what might be, right? And when will we get to, and look, I'm not here to bash, you know, Bob Nutting, but when will we ever see the day again where we will be able to hold on to people like Paul Skeens? You know, where we'll be able to not just, you know, luck we get a generational talent, but to be able to keep these folks here and hopefully bring a championship back to the people of the city of Pittsburgh.
Oh, I'm sure that's a dream everybody has. And it's probably Roberto's fault, you know, because he was so good. And you know, I play golf with a lot of the guys that were on the 60s mm-hmm. team. These guys are so much fun. If you ever talk to Steve Glass.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, he is just unbelievable. And Kent DeColvin. Yeah, these guys are just a million stories, but they were good.
Yes.
And they were very viable. In those days, they tell me, you know, they could go to other cities and they could go out in the evening and, you know, be in restaurants. And the guys today, they almost have to go to their room and stay in their room in these other cities because, number one, they make a whole lot of money where the yeah. other guys didn't. And number two, everybody's got a camera.
Yeah.
And so it's a whole different world than it used to be. But it's an exciting sport.
So
you see these guys like Otani.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Isn't he fabulous to watch? And Judge, you know, to see Baltimore and the Yankees so close.
Folks, you're listening to this over the radio. You're not in the studio. So you can't see how Bob's face is lighting up as he talks about this. And I've had the pleasure of being able to join him, you know, for a ball game as a guest of his daughter's. And I'll tell you what a phenomenal fan we have here. This isn't just somebody that, you know, just decided, hey, listen, I'll give back and help. Here's somebody who is truly, truly into this here and is living, you know, life, you know, as a Pirate fan, you know, up through all the ups and downs.
You know what's my greatest thing is, like, next week I have Young Life. Mm-hmm. I have a box for Young Life, and I have them. On the 13th, I have 40 special needs kids that are going to be down by third base. And you bring them, and then, you know, you get the parent to come and visit them and make it an experience for them. But I'd love to take different groups and charity groups, especially. Mm-hmm. So Big Brothers, Big Sisters. I would try and get a couple of Big Brothers and Big Sisters at each game. Come sit in my box.
Another great organization, my colleague on county council, Tom Baker, you know, was in community affairs there and was a big brother to a number of folks there. Yeah, big supporter of Big Brothers and Big Sisters.
What a great we have so many great organizations. And anything I can do to help be a part of helping them is great.
So tell us how, so here you are, you're part of a consortium, part of a group that saves the Pittsburgh Pirates, keeps them here in Pittsburgh. How do you get involved in the Pittsburgh Penguins? You know, in that deal, in that bankruptcy.
Well, like I said, there were about 18 of us back in the Pirates. Today, there are probably about five of us left. Mm-hmm. So either they got divorced or did something else or moved away. And so it's a smaller group, but they're very focused, and they all want your dream.
Yeah.
You know, so, but in, now that was 96. So in 99, the Penguins were in financial trouble here. The Marino, who owned them, lived in Boston. He wanted to move the team to Canada. He felt they could do much better up there. And so his lawyer told him, lawyers are important, as I find out sometimes. His lawyer told him, look, if you throw it into bankruptcy, we don't have to pay the city $15 million when we
move. For leaving, yes. Yeah.
And so he did. What he didn't, the lawyer didn't tell Marino was when you throw in the bankruptcy judge basically has control over everything. And the bankruptcy judge said, oh, I like it being here in Pittsburgh. And so he went to Mario and said, Mario, you're the biggest creditor that they owe.
Yeah, because he had deferred his salary, a large chunk of his salary,
large
under chunk. Howard Baldwin, under contracts he had under Baldwin.
Exactly. Right. And so Mario, of course, loved Pittsburgh. His kids grew up here and several of them still live here. And so he then went to see his lawyer, which Pepper. Mm-hmm. And Chuck came over and said, look, you helped the Pirates. You got to help the Penguins. And so, again, it's the lawyer put together a consortium of, I would say, probably eight different people. And we then all got together and said, okay, we'll buy it. And so we bought the team with the permission of the bankruptcy judge because Marino had no choice anymore. As long as we paid the debts and got everybody to agree. Everybody took a haircut on their debts probably down to 75%, even Mario. And then we paid that amount and bought the team.
Well, it's worked out for everyone.
Oh, it's been great. Well.
Yes.
Great. Oh, when we got Carlson last year, I thought, man, this what luck have we got. Kyle has done it. And so now we're going to take our three superstars, put Carlson with them. We got to win. We were out by 1 point at the end.
Well, chemistry is important, you know, and this is one of the things that's involved, and it's amazing, and, you know, how these folks all play together and the power play, You know, we had some struggles last year.
We had some real struggles there last year.
But, Bob, when do you find time to do anything when you're going from sporting event to sporting event or charity event?
Well, your probably wife, more time at charity events. So the nice thing about the – we just had a Penguin meeting the other day, and we're going through this year. And, you know, we've made some big trades just lately, and it's going to be fun. I just see this year is definitely a year for – those four superstars to still be with us. I believe we'll start to see maybe a possibility that some of them will be here next year. But, you know, this is probably the year. So we've gone from the Lemieux era to now the Crosby era, and there'll be the next era coming up, but we don't want that era to be too far away from here.
Right.
So the changes will start to happen, but I would say enjoy this year, because this is going to be a year where they're all going to try hard. We're going to make a couple of changes, especially in goal, to where now we're going to be in that playoff.
Okay.
I'm not sure we'll be all the way, but we'll be in that playoff.
Well, that's important. You know, they say, I mean, there's no more demanding championship race in sport than the Stanley Cup playoffs.
You're right.
You know, and if you can just get into it, anything can happen. A team can get hot. You get a hot goaltender. We saw with Murray, you know, back in, you know, when he took over from Fleury, right? How, as a rookie, it could happen, right? So we're excited about it. So, Bob, you know, so you went from all this, and then people drag you back into politics, and they say, hey, we want you to run for state rep.
That was an interesting. When I was mayor, your term limited in Murraysville. So I got done being mayor, and Eli Ivankovich was our rep, and he decided he wasn't going to run again.
Okay.
And it just, I said, if I could do so much good in our area, maybe I can do some good in the Capitol. And so I decided to run, and I represented Murraysville, Lower Borough, West Deer, and Allegheny. So I was lucky to be both in Allegheny and Westmoreland.
Right, right.
So I got to be involved with both groups. But then when I got to Harrisburg, it didn't take me too long to get a little disillusioned. You know, I thought, wow, how lucky I am to be here. The people had me come here because of a reason. And then I saw some of the other people that were there from other towns that I said, how did they get here? You know? So, but anyway, the problem is you got 203 reps. So you got to convince 101.
That's what I was just going to say. You went from only having to convince four people on Murraysville Council to how do you get 101?
And they all have different agendas. They all have different ideas. About a third of them just want to be able to be there next year and the year after and the year after. But about two-thirds of them really care and really want to do things. And so that's a good thing. And we have several committees. I tell you, if there's a committee on veterans and there's something for veterans, everybody gets behind it. Those are the kind of first responders. Everybody gets behind it. You know, it's those kind of things that move. It's the other kind of things that just slowly evolve. But I did it for 4 years. So
you got a taste of it.
I got a taste of it. I decided that they just don't know how to strategically plan. They don't, you know, they're just too diverse. And so if we could cut the number down to probably 100, we'd be a whole lot better off.
Yeah, you wonder. I mean, and you hear arguments on both sides, right? People talk about the size of the Pennsylvania legislature, the largest, you know, most expensive in the country. And then you'll have those folks come back and say, yes, but if you reduce the number, we would represent even more people, which would make it that much more difficult for folks to get in to see us and to pay attention to that.
The job of the rep is to be out with the people all the time. And so we represent 65,000 people. So if you 65,000 people, if you're out there all the time, you get to touch almost every one of them.
Yeah.
And I love it when I go and knock on the door, you know, of a house, and I'm in my suit, you know, and a woman comes to the door and she looks and she automatically assumes I'm a Jehovah's Witness.
And so that is a police officer.
I really don't have any time. I said, I'm sorry. I said, my name's Bob Brooks. I'm your representative. And I just wanted to talk to you about what you think about the state and our issues. Uh-huh. All of a sudden, they invite me in
all
house,
the time in the room, right?
You know, I get cookies, Cokes. you know, it's a whole different world. And I love that because you really find out what's going on. So I think sometimes door knocking, and you're right, if you had now 120 or 130,000, you wouldn't be able to door knock as many because
right.
the thought is always hit 10,000 doors. That's what you got to do. So 10,000 doors out of 65,000 people, you know, that's probably...
Maybe at least a quarter, probably a quarter, or at least a quarter of the homes in the district. Yeah.
And so then those people, when you knock on their door, talk to them, well, doesn't matter what party they're in, they're automatically in your court.
Right.
And they give you great ideas. And so I love that part. And I hope we keep doing that. I hope people, even if they run two or three times, get out there, knock on those doors.
You have to do that. You have to get out in the community. You have to listen, folks. And, you know, in my role, I represent the entire county, so it's over 1.25 million. I don't get to knock doors. I mean, you can, but I can tell you that I am out in the community everywhere. But you're absolutely right.
And you're available.
Yes.
People come up to you.
Yes.
You listen to them.
Yes. You know, well, you have to. Because, again, listen, we learned this in business. You know, I was a big believer. I tell people that I'm lazy. And I said, when I say I'm lazy, that means I only want to do things once. So let's do it the right way the first time, right? So I would always look for best practices. You know, instead of trying to reinvent the wheel when I saw a challenge or a problem, I would first try to look and try to understand it, but then try to look and see, has anyone else faced this? And what did they do to resolve it or to solve it, right? Because I always believe that the people that are closest to the problem typically have the best answer as to how to address it. You know, not somebody that's, you know, fully disconnected, you know, hundreds of miles away. So, yeah, so it's just, I love talking to folks and trying to, you know, and in business, you know, I've had a little bit of success myself, nothing, you know, near what you did, but I can tell you that all of that pales in comparison to what you're able to do in public life when you're able to help somebody and make a difference in their life. I tell folks when someone calls and they're looking for help, oftentimes they're at their wit's end. They don't know where else to turn. You know, they're having challenges. And when you can help them, again, make a difference. Man, you go home that day. I mean, you are over the moon.
You feel good, yeah.
You were over the moon because you were able to make a difference, you know.
When I was I was there for COVID years. Mm-hmm. And, of course, those are tough years for anybody. But one of the things I was really happy that seniors have so much trouble trying to get on the internet, uh-huh. get scheduled for their shots. So I would actually have the seniors call us, give us their information, and we would actually get them scheduled
okay.
and then make sure that they got their shots. And I had a deal with the United Way where I could do up to 200 people a day.
Oh, wow.
And it was a way that I was able to make sure that stress was off the seniors
yes.
and the most vulnerable were those that got their shots. And AHN Hospital, UPMC, they're both there at the edge of Murraysville, and they both would help me getting clinics and setups. And so it amazes me the power you have as a mayor or as a rep that you don't realize. You call the president of one of these companies, it automatically goes through.
Yes.
It doesn't go to some secretary or
right, no gatekeeper,
down.
Right.
And so they actually, and they work out a solution for you and help these people. And so anybody that is a rep has to realize they have the power to help people, and people are just waiting to get that call. They got to do it. Because as you said, there's no greater feeling than when you've helped somebody.
Yep. Well, and that's, hey, listen, Bob, that's what we here at the Republican Committee of Allegheny County want to do. We want to be able to help the members of our community. We want to be able to help send good candidates, you know, to Harrisburg and to Washington, folks who do care about our issues, not the ones you talk about who are just happy to be there and want to stay there, but people who actually want to accomplish something for the people they claim to represent. If you would like to help us out there, you can take and volunteer by signing up at our website at allegheny.gop, allegheny.gop, or calling the office at 412-458-0068. It's 412-458-0068. We'd love to have your help. If you wanted to volunteer, you can make phone calls. You can write letters, put out yard signs, whatever it may be. Whatever you can do to help, because we have critical elections coming up, and it's very important that we send the right people to Harrisburg and Washington. And Bob, we have about a minute left. What would you like to tell our listeners? Would you like to say anything to our listeners before we end?
I'd just like to say Pittsburgh is probably one of the nicest places I've lived in all the places I've gone around the U.S. You have four seasons. You have all of the cultural and hospital, education, and sports facilities. You are in the perfect community. And thanks to people like Sam, I know it'll stay that way.
Oh, nothing like pressure there, Bob. Thanks. Folks, as always, when we get started talking, man, time just seems to fly. We wanted to change it up, and I wanted to give our listeners the ability to hear from somebody who's made a tremendous difference in the lives of so many here locally, but who many don't even know. Bob, pleasure having you on the show. Thank you very much. Folks, until next week, this is Sam DeMarco, your host on The Elephant in the Room. Have a great weekend.